This is a day typically meant for rest and relaxation. Local parades, family barbecues. But no one will be marching down Main Street today, and there appears to be a consensus that it's for the best. This is the morning show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer Kent. Memorial Day celebrations have been moved online this year, and this afternoon at 3, people across the state are being asked to acknowledge a moment of silence, and followed by Taps. You're being asked to play Taps, an incredibly difficult, almost impossible song to play. You can download the song and attend virtually online today at WisVetsMemorialDay2020.com. All the links from the show can always be found at WPR.org/mornings, so you'll find them there along with the links for the rest of our guests. But I'm curious how you'll be spending this holiday. 1-800-642-1234. It's different this year, no doubt. But how did this holiday get started? And how did it remain such an important part of our culture? James Martin is an author, professor, and the chair of the history department at Marquette University. James, good morning. Thank you for being here. And I'd like to begin with a legend of Major General John Logan. Who was the Major General John Logan?
Good morning. John Logan was a politician in Illinois before the Civil War. And as such, he got the attention of the governor of Illinois when the Civil War broke out, raised a regiment of Union soldiers, and became one of the more effective so-called political generals of the war and rose to a pretty high rank. And after the war, he became one of the leaders of the first and primary veterans organization for Union soldiers who survived the war, the Grand Army of the Republic, the GAR. And so Logan, as the first commander, declared on May 30th, 1868, that that would be Memorial Day, or what was called the time Decoration Day. And the main thing was to actually decorate the graves of Union soldiers who had died during the war. Speeches were given, prayers were made. There'd be this pretty familiar kind of ceremony to what we would attach to Memorial Day. But Logan is credited with being the person who declared the first sort of official Memorial Day recognized by Union veterans.
So if you were to take us back to 1868, the sights, the smells, the sounds, what's going on in the context of the first Decoration Day?
Well, I think these Decoration Day ceremonies would have built on traditional commemoration of dead Americans. Even during the war, women would gather to decorate the graves of recently deceased soldiers. This is also a time when it's very important to identify and to rebury Union soldiers who died in battle. Many of them were buried right on the battlefield, and there's a major effort after the war to bring them into national cemeteries. Gettysburg is, I think, the first and most famous of the big national cemeteries. Arlington becomes a cemetery during the war and just after, outside of Washington. And increasingly, there are major national cemeteries near all of the big battlefields for the Civil War. And so from the very small local ceremonies that would have been in a churchyard or a town cemetery, to the bigger ceremonies at the big city national cemeteries, there'd be speeches, there'd be prayers, there'd be parade of veterans. The GAR especially would come out that day in their uniforms. And it would be, again, a very familiar sight to anyone who's been to a formal Memorial Day ceremony.
So what we saw on the first Decorations Day is we can, or at least most recently, still saw on Memorial Day here in the Wisconsin. So this group of the Grand Army of the Republic, who were among their ranks and what became of them?
Anybody could join who'd been a veteran. And so I think the closest thing to it in our modern life is the American Legion. It's a very broadly defined group. As long as you had served with honor, you didn't have to have been in combat. I think you had to have maybe 6 months of service, and you could join. And they were locally organized. These days we think of the VFW American Legion having, fish fries at their posts and so forth. GAR had local posts. They all had names. There were six or seven here in Milwaukee, for instance. There were, probably 100-150 GAR posts around Wisconsin. And they would meet once a week, once a month, depending on the time of year. They tell stories about their wartime experiences, both sort of about combat and about funny, you know, camp life. They did a lot of charity work for fellow veterans. They buy groceries. They try to find jobs for them. It's a social outreach kind of organization as well. But mainly it was to keep alive the memory of the war for themselves. It's a way for them to talk about their own contributions to saving the Union and for some, you know, ending slavery. But also to keep that contribution alive, the memory of their fellow Americans. And so they were very much about recognizing the importance of their roles in the Union effort.
Marquette University History Professor James Martin is with us on this Memorial Day as we explore the history of this day and its observances. And I do appreciate the history of the Arlington Cemetery. Would you please detail that for us, James? What was it originally?
Well, it was when the war began, it was Robert E. Lee's home. through his wife, I believe. They lived in Northern Virginia. And about the time the war is beginning, I believe Lee's family was there. Lee was, of course, in the U.S. Army. He was away, had come back, resigned from the Army, had received an offer to be a general in the Virginia forces being raised. And almost as soon as the war began in earnest, in April of 1861, probably early May, Union forces crossed the river, the Potomac River, and occupied Arlington. And it became a base of operations for Union forces. It became one of the biggest and best equipped contraband camps, as they were called, homes of escaped slaves.
Was that because it was strategically placed, James, or was that because it was Robert E. Lee's front yard?
Well, I think it was strategically placed is why it became a base. It's Northern Virginia. It's the south side of Potomac. It's a good launching point, you know, for movements into Virginia. I think it's a handy place for the slaves to congregate because it's within Union lines, and they're safe there. It becomes a cemetery during the war as well, and it's often said that's kind of because it was Robert Lee's home. It was a way of punishing Lee and his family. And so it grew into, you know, the biggest of the major national cemeteries afterwards.
So on that Decoration Day at Arlington Cemetery, what's happening? 1868?
And it's across the country, so it's not just at Arlington even. But okay. at Arlington, you'd have, I'm sure Logan was there. There'd be a parade of veterans into the cemetery. All of the veterans' graves would have a wreath of some kind or a GAR badge. You know, even this is a little aside, even around small town cemeteries in Wisconsin today, you'll see a little GAR marker for the graves of guys that they have certified to be
Sure.
war veterans. And so, again, it's very dignified. It's very plain. It's not fancy. And the speeches would be about sacrifice, about patriotism, linking the soldiers from their deaths to the future greatness of America. It's not quite a script, but it's a very typical thing that first Memorial Day and afterwards.
We're taking you back in time this morning with our guest, author, professor, and chair of the History Department at Marquette University, James Martin, Major General John Logan, and the first Decoration Day in 1868 across this country, as it still can be seen in ways today, albeit on this day, virtually and online or out your front door at 3 p.m. with a moment of silence followed by taps. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. Was speaking at Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day in 1871, Frederick Douglass made the clear case against false equivalencies in our Civil War, saying, quoting here, "We must never forget that victory to the rebellion meant death to the Republic. We must never forget that the loyal soldiers who rest beneath this sod flung themselves between the nation and the nation's destroyers. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this day is about more than the Civil War now, but Douglass's salute for the sacrifices made for the sake of the Union still reverberate through time and into today. This day is about the sacrifice of those who fought for something greater than themselves, and you can feel free to share those stories on this day at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@wpr.org. James Martin joins us, chair of the history department at Marquette University, author of Sing Not War, The Lives of Union and Confederate Veterans in Gilded Age America. What about before the first Decoration Day? What about before 1868? You could say that honoring the fallen soldiers goes back to Rome, Greece, and even prior to that. But what about in the United States? Were we seeing what would become Decoration Day prior to 1868, James?
Oh, certainly. I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, small towns and women's organizations would have honored recently deceased Union veterans and Confederate veterans, too. This is a North and South thing. And so there's a number of communities had formal occasions during the war, usually late spring, early summer, more or less around, you know, May 30th, which becomes the traditional Memorial Day or Decoration Day, rather. And it's, you know, part of this is through women's organizations created to raise money and to support troops during the war. After the war, it became they kind of evolved into the Women's Relief Corps, which was the women's auxiliary, as they used to call them, to the GAR. And so it's a very natural thing for the women to decorate the graves, to honor the war dead. It's customary, you know, as you mentioned, through history to do this. And so there were many Memorial Days or Decoration Days going on before 1868. One of the more, it wasn't famous at the time, although you can see small articles about it in newspapers, but a few years ago it was rediscovered. The kind of first post-war Memorial Day actually took place in Charleston, South Carolina, when hundreds of newly freed African-Americans held a ceremony in honor of dead Union soldiers who had died at a prison camp in Charleston at an old race course, were buried there. And that kind of becomes, in some ways, the first. I don't think Logan didn't know about it. The GAR wasn't modeling their ceremonies on this, but really one of the first post-war ceremonies was early May 1865 when, again, free African-Americans in Charleston honored the Union dead.
May help explain why, according to the VA anyway, about 25 places across the country claim connection to the origins of Memorial Day. So would you designate a birthplace for Memorial Day, or is it just it happened across the country in one way or another until it caught on for all of us?
I think it's a normal impulse in times of war and just after to honor the dead in that way. Sort of a spirit of commemoration, I think, that took place. So I don't think there's any one place that originated it. Memorial Day.
You've studied the Civil War, and the Civil War, unlike our other wars in this country, it was here at home. What was it like to be a Civil War veteran? What was it like to be a veteran of the Union or Confederate Army after the war was over? What were their lives like?
Like veterans of any war, a higher percentage of them had seen combat than in modern wars. Many of them would have been had lasting disabilities. The famous ones are men who lost arms and legs, and there were 60,000 amputations of limbs during the war. Over 600,000 died. Probably another million or so had been wounded. Many of them were just sick and worn out. Very common things that we'd be able to shake off quickly were harder to shake off back then. But rheumatism and dysentery and arthritis and various other ailments really slowed down many veterans. And so they became part of the first major social welfare system in the country, the pension system. And so the first pensions given in the United States were to volunteer soldiers from the Civil War. It becomes the biggest part of the federal budget by the late 19th century. So to be a veteran was to be honored on Decoration Day, and the 4th of July was a big day. Not all veterans belonged to a veterans organization, but many did. They had annual encampments. Milwaukee had a big one in 1880, for instance, which kind of sparked a renewal of the GAR and, you know, tens of thousands of veterans would show up. So it's very much like any other big convention in that sense. And they were very, as I said earlier, interested in promoting the memory of the war, their memory of the war, and their contribution to the safety of the United States.
So what do you think when we get to today and we take a look back and get some perspective on this Memorial Day that has now encompassed our veterans, those who are serving, and those who have fallen and beyond the Civil War from all of our military combat? As a historian, what's your outlook on this holiday?
Well, I think one of the commonalities between today and the past is the extraordinary emotional attachment that Americans tend to have for veterans of sacrifice. We've had long years of warfare in our own lives here, and a lot of attention paid to veterans coming home, and especially in the reserves and National Guard. They're really coming out of communities in the same way that war veterans came out of their communities. And so on this day and some others, support our troops, support our veterans is a very emotional appeal. At the same time, there's a disjunction between that and how veterans are treated sometimes. And not so much purposefully here in the United States, but difficulties with the opioid crisis, for instance.
Institutionally,
especially.
Interpersonally, I haven't seen those experiences, but institutionally, veterans face challenges today. And on this day, if there were any day, those would be challenges that maybe should be addressed.
There are ironies, you know, and Civil War veterans had the same thing. They had the same psychological issues, although they didn't know what to call it then, physical issues, and faced challenges in getting their pension claims approved, you know, and there was a lot of suspicion of Civil War soldiers who were receiving pensions among some parts of the population.
Explain that a little further, James Martin.
You had to prove that your disability was related to your war experience. And since most of the disabled weren't really obvious, I lost an arm or a leg or my sight, it was, I'm sick, I can't work very hard, I can't, you know, I'm suffering in that way. There was a very elaborate process you had to go through to prove that you were really disabled, that your disability wasn't caused by your drunkenness or your laziness or whatever. And it becomes very political because it is very expensive. This is a time when no one else is receiving a pension from an employer or from a government. It's a really special program at the time. It becomes the basis of Social Security in terms of how it's run in a way in the 1930s. And so it's not surprisingly becomes kind of a political football. At the time, the Republican Party is the one pushing for pensions and for government care. The Democratic Party tends to be, as I said before, just suspicious of the whole pension program. And it becomes, by the 1880s and 90s, a very controversial thing.
A few minutes we have left here in learning about you, James, I have found out that among everything else, you're also the co-editor of a 6-volume anthology of the history of children and family. Mm-hmm. Families right now are facing challenges they've never faced in their lifetimes. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask if you could provide some perspective on what families are going through today and what history suggests they might expect in the days to come, months or years.
Well, let's see. I think from a historical standpoint, this is pretty unique in that we have so many institutions that shape the lives of children and families today that even 30, 40, 50 years ago did not, probably not 100 or 200 years ago. And so I think one of the differences about this particular moment in time is we've kind of lost those institutions up to a point. My kids are grown. They're not here now, but the schools are playing less of a role in their everyday lives. We're not going to the doctor as much. There's many institutions aren't in our daily lives anymore, and even for adults for that matter. And so it's a little bit uncharted in that sense. How do we get back to that? How do we recapture those institutional relationships between children and families and the government or local communities or nonprofits? There's lots of things that have to be rebuilt 200 years ago, you were kind of on your own anyway, in a sense. And we're used to not being on our own now, and this has, in a certain way, I don't want to exaggerate it. There's still been plenty of support, obviously, but there is it's a different kind of relationship that one has to an institution if you don't interact with it, you know, personally, any given time.
I very much appreciate the perspective, James Martin. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
James Martin chairs the History Department at Marquette University, specializing in the Civil War history, and the co-editor of a compendium on children and family history. Up next is news. Then we take a look at how the Department of Veterans Affairs has been managing the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.